Welcome back to The Civ. I'm Karen Anderson, and this is the podcast where we sift through the stories, choices, and values that shape the way we live. Today's episode is a little bit special. It's a take two. I first spoke with today's guest, Charles Dowding, last week, and through a small technical disaster, which was completely my fault, that conversation was sadly lost. But Charles, in his typically generous way, agreed to sit down with me again, and I'm so grateful that he did. If you don't already know Charles, he's the pioneer of no-dig gardening method, the author of more than 15 books, and the creator of a hugely popular YouTube channel that has inspired millions of gardeners around the world. But what really drew me to Charles isn't just his expertise, though that came in incredibly useful. It's the philosophy behind it. His work is rooted in values, patience, trust in nature, and a quiet generosity that feels more needed than ever. In this conversation, we talk about what led him to create his first no-dig garden, the lessons he's learned from a lifetime of working with the soil, and how the values that shape his approach to gardening can shape the rest of our lives too. So for the second time, and with even more gratitude, here's my conversation with Charles Dowding. Charles, I'm so delighted that you said yes to being here again. I wanted to invite you on The Civ because as a very grateful consumer of your content, your work feels like it goes far beyond gardening. It's about values and how they shape the way you live and work. And the way you talk about the soil and trust in nature and have patience and share your knowledge so generously, it really struck me. And I knew that our listeners would gain so much from hearing not just what you do, but why you do it. For anyone who might be listening, and this is their first touch point with what you do, how would you describe who you are and what you do?
Well, thank you, Karen. No-dig gardener. I'm basically a market gardener, been doing it since 1982. And I got interested in nutrition when I was at university. I actually became a vegetarian after reading a book called Animal Rights. But I'd grown up on a farm. I grew up on a dairy farm. So this was all new to me. It's been a voyage of discovery ever since, really. I'm always fascinated to explore things to do with health and nutrition and growing, because from a farming background, I loved growing vegetables, which I started doing when I was about 19 or 20. And I'm now 66. I've had a good life doing this, and I'm still carrying on. I now run a quarter acre, very intensive, no-dig market garden in Castle Carey, or near Castle Carey in South Somerset. But I've moved around. In my life, I've had four different market gardens. And I've done a lot, and it's been a kind of life voyage as well.
Right off the bat, I'm wondering how you becoming a vegetarian was received by your family who were farmers. How did that go down?
Yeah, well, I guess you know to ask that question because it's a very good one. My father called me a rabbit.
Yep.
Yeah, they thought it was right strange. My mother was hugely supportive, and she used to cook me lovely quiches and nut roasts and things. It was a rare thing in those days. You know, I was at university in 1979, being a vegetarian, and I had to have long discussions with the cooks in the kitchen. I was at the Cambridge, actually, in a college there, and it was new for all of them as well. So, yeah, it feels like that's been my whole life, really, discovering things and then explaining them. And then I started off being organic market gardening, and because that was the only way I wanted to do it, I very switched on to just doing things naturally. I don't like synthetic chemicals. I don't actually like machinery very much. I've driven tractors on the farm, and I can see the value of them, but it's not my thing. So I managed to work out how to create beds. I used a tractor to rotivate, actually. Started cropping that in 1983, went really well. And, it was all organic approved by Soil Association. And then I thought towards the end of the year, I'd been wondering what to do because I'd made these beds.
Yeah.
But I made an acre and a half of raised beds. It was really hard work. My father, again, worked that out. But, it was good. And then I thought I'd been looking at soil and how we look after it. And I'm very drawn to, no-dig wasn't a phrase in those days, the principle of leaving soil alone. And I came across some old writings through the Soil Association, people who had been doing it. An amazing guy called F.C. King, who was head gardener at Leverholm Gardens in Cumbria, 1930s and 40s. And he'd done some trials even comparing dig and no dig. He didn't call them that exactly, but yeah, it was very favorable to no dig. And that just got me underway. And so towards the end of that summer, I thought, well, I'm not going to do any cultivation of these beds. You know, felt like a risk in a way because no one else was doing it. But it worked. And through the 80s, I was doing no dig right from the beginning, over 40 years. But no one, I never really talked about it because no one was that interested in it in those days. What they wanted to know more about was being organic, because that was rare in those days. I mean, it's not that common now.
No, indeed.
I used to do it with Jeff Hamilton. We did a whole program. It was a whole program I've got this world about my garden. It was screened in March 1989. I don't know if there's any access to that.
Surely there must be.
It's quite funny. I was 28 at the time and looked very young and innocent. Also, for some reason, I had a slightly posher voice. I thought, I don't know what's going on there. Jeff was there asking me things. You know, he was there for 2 days. I got to know him. He's a really nice guy. And he said, so Charles, he said, you've grown these amazing cabbages and you haven't used any fertilizer or chemicals. And I said just one word. I said, well, no. So, you know, to me, that was just a big question because it's like, why shouldn't that be possible? But, you know, that I feel that little exchange explains where most people were in those days. I just couldn't believe that it was possible to grow food naturally. That's pretty shocking, but that was the belief.
What gave you then the conviction to follow your beliefs and not conventional wisdom then? Where did that come from?
I don't know. Maybe I've been lucky, but I do have the courage of my convictions. And I'm not a great shouter, so I'll just keep my head down and get on with it.
Yeah.
And that works for me. You know, I'm saying that as it works. And if people are interested, I'm very happy to explain it. And for a long time, that was just how it was going. And until really social media arrived, and that enabled me to put my work out there and cause a lot of interest.
Absolutely. You often describe the soil as this living organism, something that we can relate to and that we should respect rather than manage. And it can do, it knows its job, right? Was that always your instinct, or did it grow as you watched the soil kind of respond to that?
It's just a feeling built up over many years. And now, you know, I think many people do feel that way. It's becoming almost mainstream, you might say, I think. Seeing the soil as a living organism, it, you know, kind of makes sense that it would be. It's the skin of the earth, you could say. But, you know, it's only recent. And before that, it's a whole attitude to nature, really, which underlies that change. If you think how people viewed nature in, say, in UK, at least in Victorian times, it was very much man having dominion over nature. And it was very much man, not woman as well. You know, it was very male. And we still got legacies of that, obviously, unconsciously, a lot of it. And that's one reason I kept my head down, actually, because, you know, I could see and feel that it's hard to realize, actually, how strong it is. And then it makes me realize, how do we ever make progress here? Because on anything, you know, the force, the weight of energy behind accepted ideas and beliefs is really strong. You can see evidence right through history. So I feel that I've done really well, actually. I give myself a small for, you know, getting no dig out of there. I think without social media and having the ability to send photos of this beautiful garden all over the world, which wasn't my intention when I started doing it at all, but it's what's happened. It's clearly reached so many people. And I think that gives an energy to a new way of seeing things.
Absolutely. We'll get on to social media in a minute, but well before Homemakers, before the YouTube channel and all the books and things, there was Iona. And this is where you set up your first organic garden. What drew you there? So remote. I went for the first time last year, absolutely fell in love with the place. So I understand why once you got there, that's where you would want to be. But what drew you there in the first place?
Well, it was an advert in the Soil Association magazine.
Really? In
1981. Because I'd left university not long ago, I was twiddling my thumbs at home, not sure what I wanted to do with my life. You know, I knew I wanted to do something with land and food. And there was an advert for this hotel on the Isle of Iona, and they were offering a small wage accommodation. And it sounded far away, which actually suited me at the time, just get away from the family. We all need to do that when we're young. And I ended up in this hotel and discovered the people are really organic-minded. They were fantastic to work for. And they were running an organic garden. It wasn't no dig for sure, but it was organic. But I was not my job. I was maintenance man of the hotel. Because okay. On the farm where I grew up, I'd done a lot of DIY work. And so I was making signs and painting windows and decorating and anything else that needed doing. But then one morning, something significant happened one day when I injured myself and I couldn't do my normal work. They said, you could help the garden then. And I went up there and they said, oh, you could do some weeding. And I couldn't sort of bend down because my knee was dodgy. So I actually knelt down on my knees. And I don't know if it's the special energy of that place, but I came to realize, somehow attracted to this amazing energy island. If any of your listeners don't know, it's pretty extraordinary, isn't it? That's been the story of my life. Again, down here, I live near Glastonbury. Yes. And Glastonbury, Iona, Findhorn are the three big energy centres of the UK, really significant places. So, good there. But I've never been to Findhorn. One day I'll get up there.
Well, you should do that. I'm going to visit, actually. Ironically, my partner's a musician and he's doing a gig there next year. So I get to go and visit. That'll be fabulous.
Do go.
Absolutely. That'll be wonderful.
Because also the story of Findhorn Garden really inspired me. You know, again, a long time ago, 1990s. Read that and that, you know, and the nature spirits and all that kind of thing. That is my thing. I'm very much in hidden, invisible energies. But that's been a really hard thing to talk about without being just all the woo-woo or tinfoil hat, whatever the crazy freaking thing is. And I put that on YouTube sometimes if I talk about it. But I do more now because I feel the time is right. And I haven't got what people call scientific evidence, but that's a dead end, actually. If you try and go down that road.
Well, that's it. You're getting the empirical research right in front of you, aren't you? You can see it with your eyes and presumably taste it in the produce too.
Like, you can feel it, you can taste it. It's all around kind of energy. Which may sound a bit vague because it's energy. It is a feeling. But yeah, when you get to the flavour, I wish that more children could have a taste of real food. I think it's so tragic that they're not finding out what they're missing. You know, you don't know what you don't know. And they're really in that situation because if you haven't tasted a freshly pulled carrot and you've just been eating the ones you're given from industrial chemical fields, you know, that's not a carrot at all. So there is a way because people's passions can be ignited. I feel that's where that can change things, but it needs that emotional drive as well as knowledge, and you know, you can give lectures and all that kind of thing. It's not quite the same. Taste buds are a really good pathway to the brain.
Good way in, isn't it? Absolutely. Maybe schools should have their own vegetable gardens. That would be wonderful.
Yeah, I wish everybody could have a small vegetable garden and have access to the food from it. Not that you eat all the time every day, but enough that you will notice.
Absolutely.
You're getting microbes from the soil. You can do an herbic garden. If anyone's listening to this, check out my work. It's a lot of free information on my website. You can find out how to start just a small no-dig garden. And that is very healthy soil because no-dig, you're not disturbing all the soil life. It stays strong and healthy. And that is picked up by the plants. And say you harvest even some leaves, salad leaves grown in soil like that, they've got some of those microbes on them. And unless they're filthy dirty, I'd recommend not washing stuff, but eating it fresh from the garden as naturally as possible. And you are then picking up those microbes into your own gut. Like, you know, it's now being talked about a lot, the soil biome, or the microbiology of the soil. Below me down is pretty much the same as the gut microbiome. And some nutritionists are actually saying people should eat some soil Well, my mother said that. They're catching up with the old knowledge. And that's really healthy for you because the gut is 1/4 of your brain and 80% of your immune system. You know, for goodness sake, what are we doing ignoring all of that vital information? So a little bit of super healthy food is a powerful pathway to health, and not only health and well-being, but also brain power, you know, because it's linked to the brain and how capable we are of thinking things through and working out life.
That's it. I was listening to another podcast earlier all about the gut microbiome and everything. And they were talking about, it was about sugar cravings they were talking about. And if you just cut sugar out within something like 7 days, you no longer crave it. It's as simple as that. But we can't get to the 7 days because we're all addicted.
Sure, it's hidden in foods that we eat. That's another one.
Precisely that. I think that's it. But it's not hidden in a lettuce or a carrot or a potato that you pull out your garden.
Yeah, occasionally I do eat some sugar. Not because I want to, but I'm actually diabetic type 1. That's a bit of a history of sugar for me. I overdid it when I was younger. people do say that honey doesn't come with sugar, which I'm very, very sure about. If you still want some sweet food.
You spoke there about that there's so much available content on your YouTube channel and on Instagram and things. That's so interesting to me, how much information you give us there freely. And I think that's so generous of you. What, you know, in a world where we monetize everything, what sort of propelled you to do that, to jump into the social media world?
I want to share it. I earn some money on YouTube. You get a small income from advertising and if you views on your videos, that kind of thing. So that helps. That pays my costs, you could say. It's not cheap to make lots of really good videos.
No.
It frustrates me. The other side of the coin is I can accept when I see how people are being misinformed. You see or understand the evidence for it. Because in gardening, I just know that you're gardening because I know it so well. Like, you know, let's give you an example of making compost. And it's commonly taught, said, and believed that compost heaps should have slats inside to let the air in.
Yes.
Completely wrong statement because you actually don't want air flowing into a compost heap, which would cool it down and dry out the edges. So you're actually, I know this from experience, it works much better to have solid size. And actually, if you're making compost with pallets, which is a great thing to do, and most people think that's great because it's letting the air in, but I line them on the inside with cardboard in the water moisture, and I get great compost, you know, so I see the evidence of that. But that's just an example of you know, I would say probably at least 3/4 of gardeners believe that as a true statement. And because why? Well, they haven't really thought about it, maybe. And when enough people say or believe something, it's what I was saying in the beginning, you know, it creates a strong field of belief that's hard to break through and change. I keep banging the drum. That's one thing that I do.
I'm so glad that you do.
I love the feedback. That also is one great side of, well, most of it anyway. 99% of the feedback. In the gardening community, people are really friendly and they're also happy to share. You know, there's a lot of sharing goes on. So I feel it's a really good place to be in the gardening community. And I feel that we can change the world, actually. If enough of us get, for good, you know, if enough of us get together and get organized and do great work, like I'm describing it, eat healthy. And that can create an energy that pushes back on the lot of evil forces in the world doing horrible things. And we're not going to get anywhere by going out and campaigning against them. We need to do our thing quietly. I can see you nodding your head, and you've obviously thought this through.
Well, it's true, isn't it? And it's the kind of same logic that I've applied to vegetarianism, or very recently now I've adopted veganism. Is that, you know, people will often say to you, what difference does it make? You're just one person. But it's that idea, isn't it? That if we all do our little bit, then there becomes this sort of mass of us who are doing something good, and it all matters. You know, every little bit matters. And the alternative is doing nothing. And that doesn't seem acceptable to me.
I mean, dating has been the big one that, you know, most people until recently have believed it. Is necessary. Even certainly well-known people on BBT, you know, they carry on doing it. And that disappoints me, but having said that, I kind of get it because if you've got to stick your neck out at some point if you want to change things. I feel with no dig, it's got enough evidence behind it now and enough people getting amazing results. Actually, we've got to get the feedback a lot. really emboldens me to say it a bit louder, and I'll see what happens.
That's it. On the no dig thing, obviously we're all following you, but for you, this must have created a community and, you know, reassurance that not only you're getting feedback from the soil and your produce, but you're getting feedback from the community too, that what your advice they can replicate your results elsewhere, which must be really reassuring, I would have thought.
Yeah, sure. Yeah, I mean, it's been amazing to, you know, I didn't mean to start a YouTube channel, but that just happened because one of my salad customers was visiting to collect her salad in 2013. And she said, oh, gosh, it's amazing what you've done there. And that was after I moved to home, because all within a year or half a year. And she made a video about this. And I thought, how do you do that? And what do you do with it? And she said, well, my brother's a videographer. And so it all happened by October 2013. I put up my first video. And yeah, I was curious to see, would there be a response? And the video was called No Dig Abundance. You know, I'm very enthusiastically showing the results of my first year at Homemakers. And it did attract a good response. And that led me to invest more time and effort into my channel, which I really enjoyed because I could work with my son. When he started filming here, he was only 15. And, you know, he's grown up with it, you could say. And he'd recently switched because he found working on a screen a lot quite lonely. He's become a teacher in London, in Wembley, and he's loving that. But I had the benefit of doing that. And that was great for me personally because it was a chance to
It's perfect.
Get my with each other.
Wonderful. I think that's it. There's something about gardening as well, the act of it, that, you know, it has the potential to kind of shape your values as well, as, or not just your habits. Would you agree with that?
Couldn't agree more. Yeah, that's so true. Without you at first realizing, but there's a lot going on when you're out in the garden. Well, typically, I'm sure many of your listeners will recognize this feeling. You go out in the garden to do something, and before you know it, you've done six other jobs, and then a bit of weeding these days, whatever it might be. All of that draws you in. And at the same time, you are breathing in bacteria like Bacilli vacca, which is hanging around in the air over gardens and plants. And it's the bacteria that our brain needs to make serotonin. So there you have a good reason why we feel so good to be in the garden. And that keeps drawing you back then, because once you got that feeling, it's like you get a bit hooked, and there's no nicer place to be, maybe except in the middle of winter. But in the summer months, the energy out there. I mean, when I say energy, coming back to that word, and the feeling just wanting to be there. And that I wish I could share that more on, say, YouTube. Although in many ways, I feel I do actually. Oddly enough, it kind of makes sense. But a lot of people ask me, "Hey, Charles, what are you on? Are you on the weed? Are you drunk?" I get asked that quite a bit.
Really?
Totally not. I would never make a video drunk or on the weed. But that's just how I'm feeling when I'm really happy, and I'm happy to express that. And
It's wonderful, isn't it? I love that. Do you think, though, for people who, you know, so many people live these busy, busy lives and can't, or maybe even have the outdoor space to do it, but they can have a herb pot on their windowsill or whatever. Is there still value in that, do you think? Do they still get a hit of what you're talking about?
Yeah, more than a bit, I'd say. You know, even small things you can get a lot from, and you're just witnessing the growth of a plant and feeling how it's offering something for you to eat. And, you know, plants are incredible, actually, what they put up with. And I feel I've used in some ways, but not really breakfast. Well, when I'm harvesting, you know, it's like I'm picking lettuce leaves and things. I don't use a knife much. I don't like cutting plants so much, but also taking lower leaves off tomatoes and that kind of thing. But, you know, for the purposes of what we want, I do a bit of pruning and kind of thing. I probably should sort of talked a bit. I can't feel it. But plants, you know, you look at how much they give us, and also then, you know, I get a feeling of how much they're communicating with each other, and interplanting. Excuse me. Interplanting is one of my favourite ways to increase growth by popping in little seedlings between quite large existing plants. Like, say, in June, you can pop in a kale plant between onions, which are big by that time and using most of the moisture and light. But this little kale plant is kind of hidden down amongst the onion leaves.
Yeah.
And you think, what's it going to do there? But it's not long before the onions start to mature, and then they die back or start to die back. And then suddenly you realize that that kale plant emerged. If you look at how it works in nature, there's very few plants start their growing in open spaces a long way from any other plants. Regularly,
really?
We do that when we, say, plant up a bed of cabbage or whatever. You know, I do it as well sometimes. That, when you don't copy nature, that's where problems can happen. More pests and disease and that kind of thing as well. So I'm learning all the time with these things. I find that within this interplanting I'm describing, that if I can start plants off about 4 weeks in the ground before another bigger plant is going to finish, they grow really well. And I'm convinced they've talked to each other. And actually, a bit like that, have you heard of Suzanne? I can't remember the surname, the forester who talks about the mother tree in the forest.
No, tell me.
So that's the tree. She's worked it out somehow. She's a very prominent forester. I don't know how she described it in Canada. And I was reading it in her book. But yeah, one tree that takes on that mother role of looking after the other trees, or kind of holding the balance points for the whole forest or wood, whatever it might be. And I kind of feel it's the same in a vegetable garden. I feel there are certain plants that, you know, maybe not even vegetables, actually. It could be a little tree in the corner or whatever, that are just keeping the energy right. And also organizing help for little seedlings, because 3 weeks old, they're still pretty small. So they take more strongly, grow more vigorously than if I just sow them on their own. So I feel there is some help being given. There's interrelationship. And you can explain that scientifically, again, by, you know, mycorrhizal association. And I see it, like I mentioned, the kale and the onions. But most mycologists say brassicas do not mycorrhizally associate. They haven't found evidence for that. I'm convinced they do. I'm sure the consensus view will change on that, because, boy, has it been changing all my lifetime. When I started out 40 years ago and more, the view was amongst the mycological community that vegetables do not do mycorrhizal association. In the early ages, it was just trees and shrubs, woody plants that were thought to use the mycorrhizal association. And look how that has changed now. People talk about it all the time. But it's still brassicas. They're holding out.
They're holding out on them. It's only a matter of time.
Yeah. Well, I do feel that. Because, you know, I see the evidence here. And if you're seeing evidence, well, it's obviously happening. Like, for example, I run these two beds side by side, dig and no dig. One bed I dig every year, put the compost in a trench, blah, blah, blah. The other one I don't dig, same amount of compost goes on top. And then they both... I receive the same plants at the same time every year, harvest at the same time. So it's, the idea is to compare growth with that one variable, dig and no dig. And cabbages, brassicas generally are stronger on the no dig. And if, you know, it's like, well, if they're not mycorrhizally associated, what's causing that? And it's very interesting too, how sometimes the plants don't necessarily look bigger, and we pick the leaves and weigh them, and there's more weight in the leaves from the no-dig soil. And so, well, what's going on there? You know, some people say that could be nutrient density.
Yeah.
There's so much we don't know, and I'm not able to measure. So I feel it's arrogant to dismiss any of this stuff as, you know, nonsense. If you don't know, if you haven't got the evidence behind you to do that, I feel there needs to be a stronger sense of curiosity. Something I'm always saying when I'm teaching, you know, get curious about things. Ask the questions. If you don't ask the questions, you can't find the answers. There's not many answers out there. I would say there's plenty to discover.
Yeah.
Be emboldened.
I love that. I'm getting this vibe from you, Charles, that your convictions are strong, right? You've got this, you've got very strong ideas about everything, but also this kind of ability to be wrong if you're wrong, but also stay curious and be persuaded of new things as they come up. That's quite two opposite ends of the balance, perhaps. But what that gives you is the courage to sort of to stand out on your own and say something new, but also be open to new things. I love that.
Well, thank you. Yeah, I feel I have a lot to be humbled about. You know, that's quite a good phrase, actually. Every so often one is reminded that you don't know it all, that's good. So it keeps my feet on the ground, and also able to communicate, I feel, with people I want to communicate with. I don't want to be, for me, there's no joy in talking to people in power. Because they're in power, that thing of trying to change the world from the top down. I feel it doesn't work. I want to communicate with everybody. And if you can do that, if you're not too dogmatic about things. And I notice it too, I'm reminded of it when I meet people who are dogmatic, and I can see how they're not in a good place because, they're just saying things and they keep saying the same thing over and over. And they're not really explaining it. That's, I feel, is the art of good teaching. It's not just to say things and give information. And there's a very nice saying linked to that, which is, it's not what you know, it's what you understand. And I wish, examining bodies of the country would take that one on, because, it's a cue and an exam to display how much you know, isn't it? And that doesn't mean you've got valuable knowledge. It really doesn't.
Did you forget the second after the exam as well?
Yeah. I mean, so with gardening, going back to this, it's like, look around, wonder, how do plants actually grow? How do they get all of the nutrients that enable that to happen? It's a miracle. When I look at my leeks from 1 week to the next in the late summer, especially if it's rained a bit, and you can almost watch them grow. And we don't really understand how that all happens. And there's been so much emphasis on fertilizers, which is simple chemical nutrients, NPK, and not enough attention really paid to molecules and organic compounds, which maybe that's key to how plants grow. And that fits with organic growing, not using synthetic fertilizers, which also links to what you were saying about sugar. Sugar's a very one-dimensional, it's not a food, is it, at all? It's something that's degrading us, and refined sugar. You can understand many other things that result on this, say, garden that have plants grown and so on. And all the wonderful mycorrhizal associations, bacterial associations by plant roots to help them find what they need, which, again, I would say we don't necessarily know quite what it all is, but you don't need to know. What you need to know is how you can enable the process for them to grow, and that's nothing. You leave the soil and then leave all the life in there intact, and then it can do the work it's programmed to do and joyful to do, happy to do. It's about bacteria and fungi finding food in the soil for plant roots, and in return, the plant roots secrete carbon-based compounds, which are called sugars. Ironically, they're basically carbon whole foods, I'd rather call them. And the only source of food for fungi and bacteria and so on. And that is what powers that, where the plants get this carbon-based food from, it's from photosynthesis. So everything comes back to the sun. Sun energy, which enables photosynthesis, which means translation of carbon dioxide in the air into carbon compounds in the plant and oxygen released back into the atmosphere. So highly beneficial for us. That's why they say the Amazon is the lungs of the rainforest, is the lungs of the planet. And it's adding carbon is fertility. So the more leaves you can have, sometimes I liken that. I say vegetables are cover crop. Some people use that phrase, or greenery, which is a term used for plants that through their growth add nutrients to the soil as they then rot down. And there's a lot of confusion about that because often people talk about growing a green manure and then, well, how do you get rid of it? And, they dig it in. Almost going backwards as much as you went forwards. With my favorite green manure is Massilia fasciata, which are plants killed by frost, mostly, so they just die on their own. And then the organic matter, it's all about adding organic matter. This is October now, and I'm looking out at my garden now. Can't see a gap anywhere.
Yeah.
Full. And that's my aim until, about mid-November, both daylight and temperature fall away pretty fast. So we're taking final harvest. And then I'm not trying to grow something over winter because I feel that's another mistake that some you know, I hear people say, oh, you can have living roots in the soil for 12 months of the year. And I would say that's people who have not ever run a garden, as in I mean, seriously, you know, that, again, you know, what qualifies you to say that in any context? It needs clarity and specification. So, because if you, what I found, if you have living plants somehow magically growing through winter, which they don't really do anyway, but they can do a bit in mild winters. In early March, slow down your work in the early spring. And the other thing that happens is leaf cover too much in the winter. I found results in quite a population of slugs. So, you know, just in practical terms, I don't do that. I'm happy for my green manures and vegetables to pretty much be all gone, except for overwintering leeks and broccoli and things like that. There's still quite a few of those. But three quarters of the garden is empty of plants by Christmas, say. But that doesn't mean the soil is bare. This is a really important point. You know, with no dig, you're mulching. So you're putting, I'm putting compost on top once a year. Over the next 2 months, really, as beds become empty, or before we plant broad beans or, you know, garlic, a few overwintering plants. And so the soil is nourished and protected and fed through winter months, and it's then beautifully ready for spring, new slugs, and everything flows from mid-March onwards.
That's perfect. Good. That's a wee talk for me.
I didn't mention that there was weeds, because I've got to a point here when there's very few weeds. I do forget to mention it sometimes.
Yes.
I know that most people have a lot of weeds. So it's one thing, you have a lot less weeds if you don't disturb the soil. So I'd say that's number one. But if you're starting with a lot of weeds, you've got to do some serious mulching. Like starting with a lot of weeds, the first year is going to be different to mother them, basically get rid of them by light exclusion so they die in darkness. That's my method. Sometimes use black plastic for a while as well. Sheets that you could move around the garden. But then ongoing with weeds, once you've got rid of the what you had in the beginning, the difficult ones, just keep on top of weeding. Don't let them take it. Sometimes you'll say to me, weed, there's nothing wrong with a weed, it's a plant in the wrong place, or whatever they, or they say, you know, it's there for a reason. Again, that's really easy to say, but if you haven't run a garden and you haven't had the experience of chickweed or groundsel going to seed, which they do so readily and with hundreds, thousands of seeds flying everywhere, and then you try and plant a lettuce or soaps and carrots, you'll know that it's hard to grow your food. But you've got to recognize that weeds give, you know, make the boundaries with weeds. I have weeds all around my garden in the wild areas around, but not where I'm trying to grow food. That I keep really clean, and I think that's really important. And again, if people get confused because they hear this thing about, some weeds is good, and, you know, it's, no, not where you're trying to grow vegetables. That's my view.
Of course. I know, it's wonderful. It's a great wee pep talk for me. My parents, who are normally in charge of the market garden, are away in America for the next 3 weeks, and I'm being left in charge. So I've been given strict instructions, but it's immaculate at the moment. And the idea that they come back to a mess wouldn't be appreciated, I'm sure. So I've got some good tips there. Thank you. You've had your fair share of critics, I guess, and that was the same with whenever you put something new out into the world. And some gardeners, I think, cling to the identity of their traditional methods. I think there's a fine line between inspiring change and making people feel judged. And I think you do a really good job of balancing that. Is that something that you work hard to do, or is that just natural and organic thing in you?
Well, I'm naturally cautious. And like I said, you know, I'll keep my head down and just get on with it if I feel that's...
Yeah.
People don't want to hear about what I'm doing, or new methods or whatever it might be. But if I feel strongly enough about something and I'm prepared to, I'd never be confrontational because that never gets you anywhere. If I get deeply critical comments on, say, YouTube, I don't go into having a, try and have an argument because you can never win an online argument. But I'll just say, yeah, fine. Well, if that's how you feel, fair enough, you know, because sometimes people do see things differently. If I've got the courage of my convictions, which mostly I have, I'll just keep going in that direction and see how many people I can help. With understanding, you know, my big ambition is always to give people a lady to the weeding you might be going to have to do and that kind of thing.
I know.
You know, how much time have you got? And probably not enough time to do everything you want to do. So if there are time-saving tricks that's what we need, and that's the kind of thing I particularly like to share. And I feel gardeners have been burdened with a lot of unnecessary stuff. You know, like you have to separate out roots of perennial weeds such as bindweed. You can't put them in the compost heap. You know, that's not true. And you can. I do. I've done it in cold heaps as well. They're not unlimited energy. You know, they're finite plants. And same with blight, actually. Blight on potatoes and tomatoes, you know, late blight. The blight spores can't survive in soil and compost. That's a fact. You can look it up. They need living tissue to survive on. So if you compost all your blighted material, it will break down and you will have more compost. And you will have saved time by not separating it out. You know, there's so many wins in that. And therefore, I think, why is it the old lie being perpetrated? Is it just because people are ignorant and they don't want to change it? They're afraid to change. They're afraid to say something that is. I think this is what it is. All of us, really, you know, we stick your neck out. And even if you feel something really strongly, it's safer and easier just to go along with the consensus view. People, like when I first put up I'll be a bit controversial here on Instagram, I've been worried about the incredible pollution I'm seeing of the sky above me. I'm very aware as I'm out there all the time, and I've been also watching the sky as it happens. I wanted to be a meteorologist before I became a gardener, and I'm so fascinated by the weather, and I keep a weather log since 1973, actually, 52 years. And I'm very aware of all the different clouds and, you know, what they are, what they're called, and shapes and so on. And what I'm seeing in the sky in the last years is just horrible. There's no way it's clouds. And people say, oh, it's contrails, it's condensation. No, because, you know, even though there's more planes, they didn't need years to last like that. And then they become thin veils. And I can't say, because they're not declaring what they're doing, but there's a lot of evidence that something's going on. And who is doing it, we don't know. How they're financing it, it's very expensive, for sure. We don't know. It's worrying. Anyway, I put this post up on Instagram, and you know, with a picture of all these crazy lines across the sky, which you never see in normal meteorology. And I said, I'm worried about this because I'm concerned how it's reducing light coming through to my plants. And what I'm saying is that the sun powers everything. It powers growth. It also powers our health, you know, things like vitamin D. And that post went out on February the 1st, 2024. Quite a storm. You're the first influencer, people call me, who's spoken up about this or said anything. I've spoken to a lot of influencers, whatever that word means, you know, people with big following. They're also concerned. And I said, we acknowledge that they can't afford to talk about it. Because what happened to me was it's called shadow ban, when basically your post, other people then say, hey, Charles, since you put up that post, your new posts are not appearing in my feed. You know, so they're kind of pushing you out of sight and kind of making me in one of us. And I've managed to hang on through that. And then someone last autumn asked me, so did autumn of the same year I put it up in February. They said, hey, Charles, I wanted to share that post you put up. And I can't. Did you delete it? Well, I said, no. And I had a look. It's gone.
It's gone?
So, yeah. So Instagram, Facebook, Meta basically took it down. If they breach, I won't say it. But what it means is they're worried. They're acknowledging, that's an acknowledgement that it's a real thing. Otherwise, why would they be concerned enough to do that?
Oh,
you know, that freaks me out. I've got many other examples. There's not time to explain them all now, but, you know, I'm building up quite a picture of something quite sinister going on that we can't even talk about it publicly without being shut down. You know, that's not right.
I literally just finished a book yesterday. It's called Careless People, and it was written by a lady called Sarah somebody, who used to be the head of global policy for Meta, or for Facebook at the time. It's exactly what you're describing, but on a far, far bigger, worse scale, that's creating all sorts of political unrest and violence. Wow. Awful thing. It's worth a read. It's called
Careless People.
That's the name of the book. It's her kind of memoir of her time working there.
Well, I don't know if they're putting it out there. I mean, I don't know. Easy to say how, if you know, because it's really strong forces, isn't it?
Yeah, massive. Anyway.
Yeah. Move on.
exactly. If you could walk your younger self around Homemakers as it is now, what would you want him to notice most and to understand?
Okay. For me, it would be to understand the validity of my own feelings and convictions. Because as a child, they're drummed out of you. And, you know, you go to school, well, I did, and I believe what the teacher said, and even if it didn't make sense and that kind of thing. Yeah. Same with my parents. You know, they were lovely people, they didn't know everything. But, you know, when I grew up, it was like children should be seen and not heard almost. I wasn't allowed to have my own opinion kind of thing. I had to believe what everyone else. So, yeah, believe yourself and grow that.
Wonderful. We'll move on now to the final sift. This is the last four questions we ask every guest. First one is, what's something you've let go of and never looked back?
Well, it licks what I was just saying. I feel I've let go of the belief that I had to belong to a club of people of my same social background and that I had to be polite to all of them and agreeable and reasonable and not dare to have my own way of doing things or discover things were different. So I'm really happy to have moved on from that.
Wonderful. Well done, you. Second question is, what is a question you keep coming back to?
Oh, well, there's a few. The big one is who really runs the world? Because, you know, I'm seeing so much more and more, you think, well, things that are going on are crazy. You know, there I mentioned it, you know, what's happening in Gaza at the moment. I mean, it's just ghastly. And you've got people on the one hand saying, oh, the Holocaust was terrible. There, it's happening right under all of our noses, and hardly anyone was allowed to mention it. So that question, that leads to the question, how is that possible? And it's a frightening question because you kind of start to question everything, actually. But I feel that's where I want to go because without that, I'm kind of beating in the dark a bit. So, yeah, keep going back to that.
Absolutely. Number three then is, who is someone whose values you admire and why?
Oh, the older people who founded the Soul Association, and that includes like Lady Farfa, who was granddaughter of Prime Minister, would you believe it? And she was from a very, very privileged background. But at the age of 15, apparently, she was on the lawn with her family and there was a shoot on the estate. And so I shot a pheasant and it happened to land right by her feet. So a dead pheasant sort of thumped on the ground. And apparently that really shocked her. And she became vegetarian right at that point. For the rest, even though she was farming animals and that kind of thing. So, yeah, she had the courage of her convictions. So she founded the Soul Association in 1946 at a time when there was some interest in it. But she was really going against the establishment. So, yeah, she, I admire her a lot.
Wonderful. And then the last one then, Charles, is if you had to distill everything down to just one thing that matters to you, what would it be?
It would be health. My own health. Because I can as an older person, I feel I've got the wisdom of many years behind me and I want to be around long enough to share that more. And I can't do that if I'm not in full health, good health, where I've got a good voice and I can still go out and do some gardening to get the experience I want to share. So yeah, health is it is. And health also, very importantly, has more than absence of disease. You know, what is health? And yeah. Actually, who said, you know, health can be as infectious as disease. And I think that's a great thing because hidden in that little sentence is lots of little nuggets. Like, you know, health is a quality of itself where you feel energized and vibrant and strong and not just, I haven't got the symptoms today. Which is the sort of version we've been sold of it.
That's wonderful. It's so true. It's the foundation for all of it because all our hopes, desires and dreams, they don't exist if our health doesn't. So I agree with you. It has to be the foundation to it all.
Yeah, and then it goes into the garden as well because it's the same story out there. If your plants aren't healthy, they're not going to do very well. Is it, you know, it's how the same There's so many ethos, principles, and understanding.
That's wonderful. Charles, thank you so, so much. I can't tell you how appreciative I am not to have one conversation with you this week, but two. It's been quite the privilege, and I really do appreciate your time because I know you're a very busy man. Thank you.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you so much to Charles for such a generous and thoughtful conversation. What I take away is that gardening isn't just about growing food. It's about cultivating values like patience, trust, and generosity, and carrying those into the rest of our lives. If you'd like to learn more from Charles, I highly recommend his books, his courses, and of course his YouTube channel, where he shares so much wisdom so freely. You can find all of that at charlesdowding.co.uk. And if today's episode has resonated with you, I'd love for you to join us over on Instagram at The Civ Pod, where we're building a community around values that shape our lives. Don't forget to follow the podcast too, so you don't miss an episode. Until next time, go gently and keep sifting.